Welcome to another edition of the Media Monitor podcast, where we analyze news and events the mainstream media won't report or misreport. Today, my guest is Dr. Benjamin Weicker, author of 10 books every conservative must read, plus 4 not to miss, and 1 imposter. Dr. Weicker, welcome to Media Monitor.
And thanks for asking me.
First, tell me a little bit about your background and what you're working on when you're not talking about the book.
Well, my background is really a great books background. So that was my first love in college over a quarter of a century ago, reading the great books from ancient to medieval to modern. And I taught in many great books programs all across the country, out in Minnesota and Wisconsin and all the way out in California and then back here in Ohio. So I've always had a love of the great books, both the ones that are epically bad, that is, they're profound, but they're profoundly wrong, and those that are profoundly good. So I've written 2 books. 10 Books That Screwed Up the World was the previous book about the bad books, but the great bad books. And my newest one is 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read, as you mentioned, and that's about the good books. So now when I'm not reading the great books, I am trying to be a good father and husband out in the country with my 7 kids, my dear wife, and a lot of animals that we're trying to make not just decorative but useful.
Well, sounds like it. That keeps you quite busy then.
Very busy, yes.
Well, this is an interesting book. You know, in preparation for this book, I mean, how many books did you actually have to read or review, or because you had this great love of great books, had you already read them all?
Yeah, these were books that I chose to best help us in our particular time, but they are great books that go all the way back to Aristotle. And these are ones that largely, you know, I've read for, you know, again and again and thought about over the years. I'm just going to mention some of them so hearers will understand more particularly, like Aristotle's Politics, G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy, Eric Vogelin's A New Science of Politics, C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, Edmund Burke's Reflection of the Revolution of France, The Federalist Papers, The Anti-Federalists, Hayek's Road to Serfdom, and then I have some literature in there, Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, William Shakespeare's The Tempest, and The Lord of the Rings. So these are all books that they have done so much for me. You know, the wisdom in all these books is just absolutely humbling for anyone to read, but they profoundly give us, you know, the insights into what the true conservative understanding of reality, of politics, and economics is, and that's why I've chosen those, and that's why I've come back to them again over the years. Because every time I read them, it's like you read them for the first time. You think, oh my gosh, you know, how could I miss that? You know, at this point connects to this point, so I hope some of that enthusiasm for these books read a lot, but read again with great enthusiasm can come through to the, you know, to readers, and they too can get worked up about them and leap in.
Well, you know, this isn't a traditional list of conservative books or ones people would think about off the top of their head normally. What type of criteria did you go through to make the final selection?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because one thing that I avoided was trying to make these are the top-selling conservative books of all the time, or these are the books that you normally see in conservative book lists. Many of the books you see in conservative book lists are just books in, say, from the mid-20th century on. And I think that's too restrictive. Conservatism isn't a merely American phenomenon. It goes back, I argue, to ancient Greece. If you can see these conservative principles all the way back in Aristotle. It's, again, found not just in America. That's why we include English, French, Irish, Austrians as among their members. So what I was trying to do was stay away from books that are more popular conservative books that people are going to read anyway, and go to those books that are far more profound and give them a far greater grounding in the conservative principles. So I had in mind something like, you know, Russell Kirk's work, who did such a wonderful job of introducing people to those, the deeper thinkers of conservatism that they're not likely to see in the bestseller list, but should be in every conservative's library. And really, you know, in their heart and mind, although we see that Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom is in the bestseller list, So, you know, it's possible to be profound and also popular. But I treat Hayek in here, but there are other ones that people probably aren't going to pick up, like Aristotle's Politics or Eric Voegelin's New Science of Politics. They really need to be known. It could do so much to better ground conservatives during these very difficult times we're now experiencing.
So you had some difficult decisions to make because you met Russell Kirk, and yet you had to leave him out because it didn't quite make, you know, whatever your criteria was. But it's a very interesting list nevertheless. Now, you've mentioned Aristotle already a couple of times. In the book, I guess you say that he's the father of political conservatism. Explain that to me a little bit.
Well, one thing is, I hope it surprises people enough to wake them up and say, wait a second, I thought it was somebody in the mid-20th century, you know, because conservative is a response to communism. Well, no. Aristotle was, it should rightly be considered the father of conservatism because he outlines those essential conservative points that truly do form the foundation of a more profound conservatism. First of all, he understands that there is an essential debate going on. It's a very old debate. Is the universe designed by a God, that is, and human beings have a place in that, and so they can read the moral and political order from their nature, or are human beings free to do whatever they want? Is their nature malleable? Can we create any kind of utopia we would like? And that's the sort of the foundation understanding of liberalism that goes all the way back to ancient Greek sophism. And Aristotle confronted that in his own day. He also puts the family as the natural moral, economic, and social unit in society. That's an essential conservative point that is carried through all these thinkers in 10 books every conservative must read. The family is the origin of society, the origin of our economic and political order. And moral order, and also there's a kind of reverence and respect for human nature as defined morally, so that human beings must work within those moral limits. And that's, again, another idea that's essential to conservatism, that human beings are not gods, they are not in control of the moral sphere, they cannot make up the moral rules as they go along, but these are predetermined, and our economic, social, and political flourishing depend on our keeping those limits intact.
This is very interesting. I mean, though, have you found anybody else that has said the same type of thing about Aristotle?
Yes, it's there's been a renaissance in Aristotelian studies in the 20th century, and it continues even today. People like Eric Voegelin brought him back up to prominence again, as well as Leo Strauss and some other political thinkers, trying to get people to understand, this great font of wisdom back there in the ancients. It can do a whole lot to clarify our present-day situation. He, for example, shows what happens in what he calls extreme democracy, where everyone is out to get whatever he can and defines liberty as being able to do whatever I want. Well, that sounds strikingly familiar, and it's because Aristotle experienced the same kind of mindset in ancient Athens that we are experiencing today in our own culture. So that helps us to understand that there's a way to approach these things from a wisdom that's been around. Aristotle's also considered by many to be the philosopher of common sense. Well, common sense conservatism means that human beings, as human beings, have a grasp of truth, have a grasp of those moral definitions, are able to judge the true good in accordance with what really is morally good and in society, and govern their own affairs. These are all the foundation of self-government, another principle we've adopted in American conservatism, but goes all the way back to Aristotle. So you're right to point out I don't see enough conservatives looking back at this great master, and that's a shame because he has so much to teach us. And that's another conservative principle, is that there is wisdom in the past worth conserving and which can save us from so much carnage and foolishness and destruction in our own time if we just have the humility to study that.
That's very interesting. Now, something else that caught my eye in the book was conservatives are very familiar, most conservatives are very familiar with the Federalist Papers and things like that, but you have a chapter on the Anti-Federalists. Who were they, and why should conservatives care about them?
Well, this is one of the things I'm really pushing for readers in the present time. Conservatives have a tendency to identify themselves with the Federalist Papers, and that actually presents a kind of problem. If we just go back to the time period, what we're doing is we're talking about with the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists the debates that were going on during the time of the ratification of the Constitution. The Federalists, whom everybody is familiar with, were those who were pushing for the ratification of the Constitution. The Anti-Federalists were saying this Constitution as it is written gives far too much power to the federal government, and the kind of devices that you have written into it to keep the federal government under control will not be adequate. They will soon slip away, and the federal government will gain more and more and more power. So they are warning, the Anti-Federalists are warning at that time, about exactly what has happened historically in America. The Anti-Federalists were the ones at the time saying, we will not allow the ratification of this Constitution unless there is a strong Bill of Rights that protects us from the federal government. So I'm betting, and this is a money bet, anyone, almost anyone, 90% of the people that identify themselves as conservatives, if they read the Anti-Federalists, they will say, that is my home. Those are the people who are my intellectual ancestors and who clearly stated what I cherish as my fundamental beliefs and conservative understanding. So we need to recover those Anti-Federalists. And I quote in several places in the chapter, in 10 books every conservative must read, and the Anti-Federalists, what amount to prophecies about what will happen to taxation in the federal government, how power will be drawn to the Supreme Court, how it is that the federal government will develop an enormous bureaucracy that will lord it over state and local people. All these come from the Anti-Federalists writing in the late 1700s, and when people experience how prophetic they were, they'll understand, I think, a little more clearly what has gone wrong and gotten us into so much trouble with the centralization of power in Washington.
So can you bring a tie, or would there be a potential tie between the Anti-Federalists and today's Tea Party movement?
Absolutely. I mean, I just want to say the Tea Party, and that's an important point. Because I guess I'm going to be a little too frank here. Maybe the Tea Party movement is good at having a negative reaction. They know what they don't want, but they're not altogether clear on what they do want. I think if you get 10 of them around a table, they're going to disagree about a positive understanding of what kind of a society do we want, what do we want to do, how should we live, set ourselves up economically and socially. So if they read the Anti-Federalists, they'll understand this fundamental Anti-Federalist point, and this is the conservative point, that human life, human social, economic, and moral life begins from the ground up, from the family up through, as Aristotle would say, the village, or we would say the town, the township, and the state. That's an Anti-Federalist position. They wanted strong local government, strong local economy, controlled by the people on the ground who were directly affected by their own decisions, good or bad, rather than a strong federal government that manipulates state and local activities, economics, and political and social life from a distant place. So there you have, in the Anti-Federalists, this fundamental conservative principle that we need to return to living in such a way that we are as independent as possible from a central government, and that we have a strong local life. I'm talking not just economically, but socially and morally. And that's how the nation itself was built up. That is, we didn't have a national government to begin with. It's also how it's also in line with the central conservative insight that human beings have the moral responsibility to build up life socially from their own local area upwards, not allow a central government to impose something down upon them.
Now, I want to talk about the imposter in the midst as such. You know, you included Hayek's Road to Serfdom, and you mentioned how it's hit the bestseller list. It seems to have another renaissance of its own, and conservatives really love that book. But you have no love loss, I guess, for Atlas Shrugged by Rand. What's the issue with her?
Well, Ayn Rand, I call the imposter, and actually I have her affirmation of this. Of course, she wouldn't call herself an imposter, but she did say quite explicitly that she was not a conservative, that she disliked conservatives, and there are a variety of reasons that she disliked conservatives, and she hated libertarians, too. So the people that tend to identify with her were the very ones she rejected. So that's the beginning point. Another sign of a problem here is that Rand hated Hayek. She read his Road to Serfdom and called him all kinds of nasty things, scribbled them in the margin of her copy. She also disliked intensely Ronald Reagan. So notice that you have a kind of pattern here of things that many people or ideas that many conservatives affirm, and then Rand rejecting them. Now, what I do with Rand is say, okay, folks, she did say some really important things. In fact, I think I've outlined in the chapter in Rand things that many conservatives have overlooked that are actually very profound in Rand. So I'm not saying, boy, Rand was wrong about everything, but these are the important points you can draw out of Rand. But then I also spend a good amount of time showing the dark parts of Ayn Rand, and the dark parts are very dark, and I make a direct connection between those dark parts and her explicit rejection of conservatism. So it's not, Ayn Rand has nothing to say, but watch out. You need to be aware, folks, that she shouldn't be in the conservative pantheon. One thing, she doesn't want to be there herself. She has a lot of good ideas, but there's a lot of bad stuff in there.
Well, in your opinion, then, is she misunderstood by conservatives then, or is it just kind of a case where people know about some of those things, but they choose to avoid them?
I think you read Atlas Shrugged, and they don't really come through clearly. In other words, when you read Atlas Shrugged, it kind of puts a good face on her understanding that that selfishness should be our greatest virtue. But when you look at her own life and see what she did, you understand what it really meant. And the reason we have license to look at her life as an illustration of her principles is that's just what she invited people to do. She said, "This is what I mean. I'm living this way." Well, as it turns out, she did act with complete selfishness in her life. Her husband ended up being a drunk. She alienated all her best friends. She ended up nearly friendless, and her disciples couldn't stand her, and she ruined a lot of their lives. So you have to ask, if this is an illustration of what she meant by the virtue of selfishness, it's not a virtue. She also was she was an atheist, and believed that Christianity in particular, and religion in general, were awful. So in other words, she agreed with Marx about that. And conservatives generally are going to be religious. So I argue they are essentially religious. So you can't get that, that's a problem there. And one thing that I had to end up on, very important, was her own affair with one of her disciples, which is simply a parallel to what happens with Dagny Taggart and her succession of lovers in Atlas Shrugged. For Rand, what was important is that what she called romantic rationalism, where if you were intellectually gifted, then you were sort of the object of sexual attraction too, and she put the two together. And so as you see in Atlas Shrugged, Dagny Taggart simply moves to the next highest level of intellectual appreciation of each one of her lovers until she ends up with John Galt. Well, that's what she did with her own life. She took Nathaniel Brandon, her disciple, to be smarter than her husband, Frank O'Connor. And so she simply told her husband, I'm going to have an affair with Nathaniel Brandon. That affair in her private life is in complete harmony with her arguments as presented in Atlas Shrugged. So what I'm asking people to do is, and I'm more explicit about this in the book, go read these biographies of her life. That's what she meant by her principles. You really have to understand the connection between the dark parts in her life and what her principles really entailed.
Well, Dr. Weicker, we're out of time for this segment. It's really been fascinating talking with you. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, people may stop by and visit me at my website, www.ameaningfulworldaudio.com. There they can purchase books if they'd so like, and I'd certainly like them to do that. And they can also get some free downloads. I'm doing an audio series there, and I'll be having stuff put up week after week as time goes into the fall. And so those are available for free downloads as well.
Well, that's terrific. I really do appreciate you taking the time with me to speak with me today. And it's a fascinating book. I mean, I think you have done something here that will be extremely thought-provoking for the movement. So I'm really grateful for all the work that you put into this.
I appreciate your having me.
All right. And then for our listeners, please join me again next week for another edition of Media Monitor.